Hey, this is April Wolf, host of Switchblade Sisters. Before we get into the show today, I just wanted to give you a reminder that this is the Max Fun Drive. So this is your opportunity to become a member and to help support our show specifically and Maximum Fun more generally. So what you can do is go to MaximumFun.org/join, and you can choose a monthly amount that is, you know, comfortable for you right now. A lot of people give $5 a month or $10 a month, but some upgrade to $20, $35, or even $100 per month or more. You know, it's all about what works for you and what's possible for you. And we just want to let you know that we appreciate all of it. And so here is our show today. Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about some of their fave genre films, maybe one that influenced their own work. And you guys know, like, it's a little bit weird today. Obviously, there's cats in the background today. She's a little bit frisky, so you might hear a chicken. We are recording from our homes. So there's a little bit of a difference. Hopefully, you guys won't notice the difference too much. But we also have one big difference, and that's our guest today. And that is actor and creator and kind of all-around maker, Sheila Vand. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I would love to give people an introduction of what Sheila's done. There's one particular thing I think our listeners are very familiar with, but I think people should know the whole breadth of your work because it's quite large. So Sheila was born and raised in California and attended the UCLA School of Film and Television to study acting and directing, which took her on a peculiar path of hybrid performance and multimedia artistry. She then made her Broadway debut opposite Robin Williams as Haja in Rajiv Joseph's Pulitzer Prize finalist Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo, starred in the Disney Hall's 10th anniversary LA Philharmonic staging of Frank Zappa's 200 Motels for Issa-Pekka Salonen, and had her original performance piece Sneaky Nietzsche mounted at LACMA, then co-created the award-winning visual art series Milk, What Will You Make of Me? And then, that was with TED fellow Alexa Mead, who you've done quite a bit of work with, right?
Yeah,
all right.
Collided a few times.
That show toured throughout Europe. So this series served as the inspiration for Ariana Grande's music video for God is a Woman, on which Grande worked with Vand and Mead. Now, amid all these accomplishments, Sheila has also been acting in a traditional sense of what we would call Hollywood ways, with roles on TV in 24 Legacy, Minority Report, and State of Affairs, along with a breakout role in Argo as Sahar, and in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot and Ingrid Jungerman's indie caper Women Who Kill. A good chunk of Switchblade listeners will remember her, however, as the girl in Anna Lily Amirpour's A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. But if you are an indie film buff, you'll know her from We the Animals, Viper Club, The Wave, Highway, Aardvark, and Prospect. And now you'll catch her in the Snowpiercer television series on TNT and in Dave Franco's directorial debut, The Rental. The film follows two couples on an oceanside getaway that grows dark when they suspect the host of their seemingly perfect rental house may be spying on them. Before long, what should have been a celebratory weekend trip turns into something far more sinister. And so, Sheila, can you tell us when that's coming out? How are people going to be able to see that?
Yeah, that's coming out on July 24th, on demand and in some select theaters. And it'll also be playing at a bunch of drive-in movie theaters around the country. So it's a fun movie to see at the drive-in because it's a horror film.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it'll be out there in whatever theaters we're allowed to play it in and can safely play it in.
Yeah. I mean, then you've also got the Snowpiercer television series, which was renewed for
right.
a second season. And that is
that's out every Sunday on TNT.
Wonderful.
And also on Netflix internationally.
Oh, nice. So, Sheila, the movie that you chose to talk about today is one of my favorites, and it is Possession. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
One of the things I love the most about Possession, and one of the things that took me back when I first saw it, was how explosive the energy is. Mm-hmm. It is one of the rawest movies I've ever seen. And the performances are so heightened and done with such force that I just hadn't ever seen something that was that over the top, really, just going for what it's going for with full conviction mm-hmm. and no apologies. And I also love that it blends a few different genres together. On the one hand, it's this really intense marital drama. On the other hand, it's a horror suspense film. And then there's also this little element of fantasy that gets thrown in with the creature that you discover at the end of the film. So I like mm-hmm. that it brings all these things together, but mostly the performances just slay me every time. I think they're so masterful, particularly Isabella Gianni's performance in the film. So, yeah, I just love this movie so much. I find it to be like some kind of poetic explosion of pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good description of it, because it's, as I'm about to do with the synopsis, it's not easy to describe, I would say. But for those of you who haven't seen Possession, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause and watch Possession first, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce Possession with a somewhat short synopsis. Okay, written by Frederick Titton and this is going to be me saying this name again and again, Andrzej Żelazowski, and directed by Żelazowski for release in 1981. Possession stars Sam Neill as Mark, a spy just returning from an unspecified trip to West Berlin. Upon his return, his wife Anna, played by Isabella Gianni, requests a divorce.
You can't just say you don't know. That's what you said on the phone. When will you know?
I don't know.
Do you want me to spend the night somewhere else? In a hotel or something? Do you want us to meet later on? We can talk more calmly. Do you need more time? What do you need?
He does not understand why, even though she insists on she hasn't cheated. Mark reluctantly leaves, but returns after a bender to find their son, Bob, alone in a disheveled house.
What happened? It's Daddy.
Mommy said she would be right back, but she never came. Then Margie called and told me to be brave.
He tries to make things work, but Anna takes off. Mark gets a call that Anna is with her boyfriend, Heinrich, so he goes over there and fights Heinrich.
We don't have to be brutal to each other or even impolite. Our situation is like a mountain lake we are trying to swim in, starting from different shores. I'm not astonished you're here. I was thinking about you just before you came, so now that you're here, let's be open to each other.
Then returns home, where Mark and Anna engage in a vicious brawl with an electric knife in one of the most terrifying scenes of marital.
So incredible.
Anna, help me.
Mark hires a private detective to follow Anna.
I would like you to follow my wife for a few days.
Of course.
And she leads him to a derelict apartment where some kind of creature lives. Anna kills the detective, and then when his lover comes to find him, she kills him too. So Anna confesses eventually to Mark that she had a traumatic miscarriage in the subway station.
It's as if the two sisters were too exhausted to fight anymore. You know, these women wrestling in an arena of mad, with their hands locked at each other's throats, each waiting to see who will die first. Staring at me.
And we see a haunting scene unfold of Anna bashing herself into walls, writhing, and ultimately seeping blood all over the floor. Heinrich goes to Anna's other apartment, where he finds body parts stuffed in her refrigerator.
This can't be true.
I've got to keep the place clean and real.
Oh my God.
Are you going to help me, Heinrich?
And then Anna attacks him, but he is actually able to escape. Here's where things get to be maybe a lot. Mark then kills Heinrich in a bar and stages it as a suicide. He drags a corpse inside his apartment and then fucks Anna in their old kitchen before visiting Heinrich's mother, who then kills herself while he's there. Things are off the rails. Then Mark comes upon a standoff with the cops outside of his apartment building and stages a distraction to help someone he thinks is Anna escape from the apartment. He flees and Anna follows him into a building where she reveals that, hey, you know what? It's done. The monster she's been feeding has now transformed into Mark's doppelganger.
I wanted to show it to you. It is finished now.
He tries to kill his doppelganger, but the couple is gunned down by the authorities, but the doppelganger then escapes through the roof. Shortly after, there's a knock on the apartment door where the child Bob is being babysat by his teacher Helen, who is Anna's doppelganger. Then we see Bob floating face down in the bathtub with Mark's doppelganger partially obscured and Helen staring onward with blazing green eyes.
So much to unpack.
There's a lot. Yeah, writing that synopsis, I was just like, what do I include? Do I include Heinrich's pants and his fighting style? What's the important thing here? So to start, I want to talk about Isabella Gianni, because you said, of course, this is like, you know, kind of her starring vehicle. Sam Neill is amazing as well. Like
absolutely.
Every person in this is performing at a high caliber. But of course, Isabella Gianni is like kind of this mysterious creature that we're watching and following through these things. And of course, the subway scene is, you know, iconic and has kind of turned into a meme. As actress, she's imbuing, I think, this character with a certain kind of self-sabotage that she had at the time in her own life, because as Jalowski said that, quote, when she saw the film, I mean, she went to the bathroom, took a shaver, the one you use every day with two blades, and she tried to commit suicide by cutting her wrists, which is maybe not very serious, but it caused me quite a headache. I thought I was responsible, the one to blame. If someone plays in one of my films and then is going through something like that, that means I didn't notice something, that I wasn't able to protect her. I told her, listen, you'll see. I will be persecuted for this film because it's going quite far. And people don't like to be brutalized and touched so much through the screen. But you will get all possible acting awards and your career will start again. And that's exactly what happened, end quote. And so it's just like dealing with an actor who also had those vulnerabilities, and it could not be not put onto the screen, I think, in who she is. And, you know, I think it's just in terms of casting, it's just excellent casting of this person who, you know, might have had these things going on in her life at the same time, the self-sabotage, the self-harm, and then she puts it into this film, and you can feel it. There's a visceral sense of that.
And, absolutely. She gives all of herself to this movie. And I don't know that the movie would have worked without that.
Yeah.
And Sam Neill does too. I had read that Zalowski really encouraged them to attack their roles. And there was, I think, a reviewer at the time when it came out who compared the film to Japanese theater, which I think is such a good comparison. It's like so heightened, and the melodrama. I feel like Zalowski takes the subtext of this story and guts it out and then slathers it on top of the plot, mm-hmm. which is something that I really like. I know also when it first came out, a lot of people thought it took itself way too seriously, and it does, but that's like what I love about it as well. It's part of what makes it so fun is, like I said, it's just, it goes for what it's going for with full conviction, and she does as well. And like you said, it transpires through the screen. You can really see how much she's giving, and that kind of performance work is some of the most satisfying, but it is also sometimes the hardest to process and leave behind, mm-hmm. because when you give that much, when you go there into those dark spaces, I don't know. I still feel like I'm figuring out and learning how to leave the work at home. And the more I care about a project, the more I care about a role, the harder it is to let it go when the movie's over.
Yeah.
So it's sad. I had read that as well, that she had tried to commit suicide after the movie. I really appreciate Zalowski saying, taking some ownership over that and saying, you know, maybe that was something I didn't notice. Maybe I didn't protect her well, because sometimes I do feel like filmmakers will expect quite a lot from their actors, depending on what the script calls for, and maybe don't realize, oh, I need to kind of do the follow through mm-hmm. and make sure that this isn't fucking them up and this isn't tearing them apart. But again, that's like part of the psychic thing that we do. That's like, it's hard to explain to other people
yeah.
what it's like to go that far into yourself. But for me, it's like watching it, it's a gift that that she gives us to it's a lot, you know, like it's not a movie I think most people want to watch more than once, even though I've seen it many times. But for me, I'm such a person of extremes. Like I feel life very intensely and I'm very sensitive to life, very emotional person. So I think also when I saw this movie, I was like, oh God, like it was it for other people, it might be like a punch in the face. And for me, it was kind of a sigh of relief that I felt. It was just like, ah, oh, to just see all of these feelings right in my face instead of, you know, this more subdued, really repressive kind of naturalism that I think film has been in for the last couple of decades. And even just like societally, this, like I became an adult in this, you know, internet world, and there is a lot of just phoniness and plastic. And when I saw this movie, it pierced right through all that shit with no apologies.
And you know, I think you're talking about too the fact that like this is, you know, people maybe thought it took itself too seriously, but that was, you know, part of the point, because, you know, this was based on Jalowski's private life. And he said, quote, "The film was my private life, which just exploded. I had no home, no family. My wife, the mother of my son, went away with a guy like Heinrich. This total disruption that happened in a very banal situation, just a couple breaking up, was a strong motivation for the rest of the story," end quote. And so I think, you know, he's trying to heighten the, like, this is what you feel like when you're going through a breakup. It's dumb. I mean, it's like silly. Everyone goes through a breakup, but it doesn't negate the fact that you feel like the world is ending, that there is like that there is a monster who's taken over your bed. And so I think, you know, he's trying to render that on the screen, those feelings. And for me, it works.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just it's all very metaphorical and filled with poetry for me. And I also read that I believe Jalowski was in exile at the same time that he was going through this really ugly divorce. So he was cut off from so many elements of his identity. His family was falling apart, his home life, he was banned from his home country. So I can only imagine the crisis he was going through. And I love movies that stem from a personal place for the filmmaker. It's the things that I write myself are all about an exploration of my own issues I'm working out, my own pain. And so I think that's probably another reason why I love this movie so much, is because I know how personal it is for him. And even the moments that are quote unquote too, taking themselves too seriously, or maybe a bit over the top, they feel pure to me. They feel just completely raw. And yeah, it's like you said, when you are going through a breakup, even if you know you're going to get through it, it really can feel like the end of the world. And I appreciate how, even though it's kind of Isabella Gianni's character who is doing the breaking up, you're seeing how difficult it is for her and how disturbed she is just to leave a man. And I think there is something really feminist in there, especially considering this was made back in 1980, of why is it this difficult for a woman to leave a man? She should be allowed to do that freely. And there are these amazing moments in the film that are possessive. And why I think the movie's called Possession is that all these men want her. Everybody is kind of trying to take a piece of her. And what I see as a woman just desperately trying to be on alone for a moment to figure out what's happening with herself. And there's a line that Sam Neill, who plays her husband, says multiple times. That's something along the lines of, it'll be how you want it, he keeps telling her. You know, he wants her to stay with him so badly. He just keeps saying, it'll be how you want it. It'll be how you want it. And then you just see her face like completely break down as he says it, because how she wants it is to not be with him. She does. And I don't think he even realized, like, he thinks he's being accommodating, you know. He's like, oh, I'll change, I'll do whatever you want. And to me, that is a form of male possessiveness. It's like, you have to just let the girl, the woman, go. She doesn't want to be with you anymore. But that doesn't mean it's easy for the woman to do that.
So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk more Possession and a ton of weird stuff. We'll be right back. Hey, this is your host, April Wolf, and I wanted to talk to you about the Max Fun Drive, but first I feel like we really have to check in with producer Casey, who is in the hospital recovering from a tragic stabbing, which I think maybe you heard on our last episode. He had inherited a Fabergé egg, and Casey, can you hear us? Can you see us?
April? April, is that you?
Yes, it is.
They took my egg. Took my egg. Yes, I know. I told the tabloids that nothing was stolen, but they took it. My Fabergé egg. They took it. And I don't know who it was who stabbed me. But some mysterious figure entered my room, stabbed me, and then took my Fabergé egg.
Casey.
I know.
On top of everything else.
You know, I have a few leads, you know, like I said last time, that I inherited this Fabergé egg, and it's caused a rift between my ex-wife and me, and me and my ex-wife's nephew, and me and my stepbrother, and me and the caretaker at Nana's house, and me and especially Drea Clark of the Who Shot You podcast. So it's just, it's tough right now, but I'm doing okay.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm doing okay, and all I want to talk about is the Max Fun Drive, and I think you do too.
I do, and you know, I not to be insensitive, Casey.
Thank you.
I'm.
It's really going to help my healing to talk about it. Frankly,
it's just that you know we've got a show.
Yes.
So, and you know, for this show, you know, the Max Fun Drive is what helps support us to make this show. And, you know, we know that there's a lot of other entertainment, a lot of other things that you could be giving to, and we're so happy that you are. But we are, you know, we're also very interested in seeing who can join us and helping make this show better and bigger every year. And this is your shot to join and to become a part of the show and what makes us special.
Yeah, no, I mean, our show doesn't exist without people becoming Max Fun members and choosing Switchblade Sisters as the show they want to donate to and give money to. That's how we make our money, to make this show. And our show is very unique. There are no other shows like this.
Yeah.
And the people who help us are helping make it exist and putting it out in the world. So we're just so appreciative. And here's how you can give. Here's how you can help keep this show.
Yeah.
Max Fun membership starts at $5 a month. You get all the bonus content with that. And you'll be able to access that as long as you're a member. If you choose to join with a $10 a month amount, you get a Max Fun membership. You get the bonus content and the Max Fun membership card, a cool pin, which we have a really great pin.
I think ours is going to win this year for sure. I mean, if we
what do you mean win?
Play, but you know, but like I'm a very competitive woman. So.
I think it's already won, frankly. You also get the bonus content with that and everything else. And put on a pin and you can see all your Switchblade Sisters out in the world. If you do $20 a month or more, you get this year's special gift, which is a Max Fun game pack with custom dice and custom deck of playing cards, all with Max Fun designs. But you just have to visit MaximumFun.org/join to become a member.
Yeah, pretty easy. And, you know, also maybe tell your friends to listen to the show. That helps us too. But thank you, no matter what. Thank you for listening. Thank you for becoming a member. And thank you for telling your friends about us and spreading the good word of Switchblade Sisters. We, again, cannot do this without you. I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Yes. I think something really cool is, like, I've seen a lot of people listen to our show and say, like, it inspired them to be filmmakers. And I just think, like, it's so awesome. I just don't think another podcast is doing that right now.
No.
I just wanted to add one thing, April. Two things, actually.
What?
Ooh, my wound. I'm sorry.
It's oozy.
So if you want... it's okay.
Oh.
If you want to support a little bit extra this year, but you can't do a full upgrade, like a full like $5 to $10, we're doing this thing this year called boosting your membership, where you can go in between levels, so you can get like an extra buck or another buck, and that goes towards our, you know, upgrading members total. It doesn't help with getting the subsequent gifts like at the next level, but it really helps the show, even like another extra buck if you're able to add to your your membership.
Every little bit helps.
Every little bit helps. And then I also wanted to say there's a special event going on this Saturday, July 25th at 2 p.m. Pacific. We're doing a live watch along of The Apple, which with April and the people over at Who Shot Ya, Ify Wadiwe, Alonzo Duralde, Andrea Clark. You like this movie, right, April?
Oh, my God. This is like the visual representation of my soul is The Apple.
That's great. So yeah, check that out on July 25th at 2 p.m. Pacific time. Okay, April, thank you for talking to me about the Max Fun Drive. It's actually helped my my wound heal a little bit, I think.
Oh, that's so sweet. I'm glad.
So I really appreciate you calling in. And wait, someone coming into my hotel, my hospital room? Who? Oh no.
Oh God, not again.
Oh no. I can't tell who it is. They're wearing a mask, So they're following good COVID procedure, but I don't know who's it. Who are you? Please go away. I don't have the egg. I don't have the Fabergé egg. Oh my God. They're holding a mailbox. It's the mailbox from the movie The Lake House. They're raising it above their head.
Oh my God. Oh no, Casey's been bludgeoned by the mailbox from the lake house. We're signing off. We'll return back to the show. Thank you so much for listening and becoming a member. And we'll check in with Casey. I'll give you an update. Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Sheila Vand, and we're talking about possession. You know, you're talking a lot about the, you know, like, female wanting to leave, wanting to set everything apart, and all the things that this movie is about. But I have to say that when Jalofsky, you know, lost his first financer, his first producer for this, he went to Paramount in the U.S. and just said that to them, "It's about a woman who fucks an octopus," end quote.
If only you could still do that today and get your funding.
But they didn't. They turned him down. They said no. That's like, I mean, honestly, today I think that would sell, but...
maybe so.
In 1980, maybe not so much. And I think, you know, it's... like, what is this movie all about? You know, and you're saying all these amazing quotes, these beautiful lines that resonate, and, you know, what we could think it's about. Jalofsky was of the mind that it was very specifically about the Berlin Wall, though. And that, however, differs from what his co-writer, Frederick, was saying, because they had very different ideas. Frederick was much more interested in the personal, and Jalofsky was more interested in the political. And so the two of them working together actually, I think, really beautifully married those two things, and pun intended, of how they work together and what that means. But the movie does not exist without the Berlin Wall. And I think that anyone who even just sees like the personal side can maybe say that there is an oppressiveness, this certain element about that that is haunting. And Jalofsky said, "When I wrote the script, I thought I would be really loved to make the film the closest possible to this part of the world in which the film was invented, the communist side of the world. And Berlin seemed exactly the right place, surrounded by the wall and the communist empire. To have this entrenched psychology of people surrounded by evil, and it finally worms up into their universe as a political statement. I wasn't shooting the beautiful Tower of Berlin, I was shooting the wall. For reasons, not exactly the background, but for reasons of profound necessity for the story to unravel, it had to be there," end quote. When I think about that background, I'm always wondering how aware the actors are of that when they're in that place. Because if I think of, for instance, like A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, like, so Anna Lily Amirpour is making, you know, like this very, very specific backdrop of like those kind of like oily things, like, and you have like a desert feel to it. And I'm wondering, you know, how does that affect performance? You know, this is what you're living in. This is the world that's been created for you.
It affects it a lot. It's one of the things I love the most about working on location is that you get to be far away from home. So you can really kind of cut yourself off from your normal life and mm-hmm. immerse yourself into your character and the story, and particularly a place like Taft, California, where we shot A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. It's so dilapidated. It's such a kind of abandoned Nowheresville. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time driving into it, just seeing these tumbleweeds roll by. And like you said, those giant oil drilling machines, and it just feels transportive on its own. It feels like the location itself is the set. And so of course, production design also helps a lot with transporting yourself. But I work very much in that way, where I'm very influenced by space, yeah. the space around me. And I think sometimes even of my acting as like, as I'm moving through the space, how I'm changing the shape of that space around me. And so, yeah, it feels like sometimes maybe this seems a little bit lofty and woo-woo, but I really believe that we collaborate with space that way energetically. And so, yeah, I mean, that where something is shot, it can have a huge bearing on getting your mindset into the right space. Just one less thing that you have to pretend, one less suspension of disbelief. You're just like, okay, I'm actually here. And especially once they put the production design onto the place too, like in A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, once they graffitied Farsi writing on all of the walls and put up the sort of propaganda posters that we had custom made for the movie, then I really felt like I was in Iran as well. Mm-hmm. So it was the only thing. It was like, we were in California. So, but
So something that I think could be a nightmare for an actor, something I'm going to bring up. So brace yourself.
Okay. There's so many nightmares. I'm like, which one is she going to choose? Ooh.
because Frederick Tootin and Jalovsky ended up writing out a complete character after the actor was already on set.
No.
Ooh, that's a nightmare. Okay, so so this is the process according to Jalovsky. He said, quote, "I don't necessarily write a film as a film. I write something, and it becomes a film up to the last moment when you pick this actor, not that actor. It asks for some sort of work in it. Usually the work is trimming, though, cutting the branches and leaving the main lines of foliage. During this act of cutting, this Abe character, Anna's ex-husband, was left in the story. It seemed to me, even during the shooting, though, it tries to explain too much why she was with this older man who was a writer. Fortunately, a German actor was supposed to be Abe, and I understood immediately upon seeing him, he was not Abe. And it was a happy coincidence, because his character didn't serve the clarity of the film. He was useless for a surrealistic and clean quality of the film, which asked for much cutting. All that remains of Abe's character now is his wife," end quote. So for me, that seems like a nightmare of, like, you get to set and someone's just like, actually, first off, you were never right for the part. And then secondly, like, it's not good for the story. So, like, go home.
So did they film any of him doing it or mm-mm. not even?
Not even.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, because what ended up happening was Jalovsky then called Frederick Tootin, and because he was in Paris, and was just like, you need to get to Berlin right away. And for about a week and a half, they were rewriting on set to kind of piece together what the story would be and to make it hang together still without this character. So they were doing rewrites, you know, kind of while they were shooting and in prep.
Yeah, that's tough. That's so tough. Because, I mean, on the one hand, I'm like, I'm glad he did cut that character because there's so much going on mm-hmm. in the movie already. I think another storyline might have muddied it up.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like, and I'm trying to think, I think it might be a little less painful to at least not have performed at all before your part gets cut. Because what's happened to me a lot, and is just a common thing, is you do the work and then it ends up on the editing room floor. And then that's when it's a bit of a mind fuck, because it's like, oh, was it because of the way I did it that it didn't work? If I had done it like this, would it have worked? And it's also different every time. Like, that, it's very common that not everything on the page ends up in the movie.
Yeah.
And especially with like a lot of, I think, first-time filmmakers, they might overwrite their movie. It's, I know some filmmakers, that's just a tactic to overwrite. So they have more to work with in the editing room. They know they're going to cut some of it out. And at the end of the day, like, of course, I respect the creator. It's the director's movie and the writer's movie. And if they think certain things aren't working, if they think that, you know, things are just detracting from the story that they want to tell, then I understand that it's got to get cut. But there's not really like any protocol or system, even for just like letting an actor know.
I've been in situations
where like this poor guy in Possession, where an entire character gets cut, so you're not even in the movie anymore. I've been in situations where my part gets whittled down to one little thing. Or the worst, though, is when you feel like the things that got cut out do take away from your character arc, or if you don't agree with those cuts, mm-hmm. and there's only so much input you can have as an actor. And most of that input ends when the movie wraps shooting, because mm-hmm. you don't get to be part of post at all. You just sort of give all you've got and then hope that,
yeah,
you know, the right things stick. And it's kind of part of the job to just be okay with that. But sometimes I do wish there was just a little more like I think, you know, for any filmmaker listening to this, like, tell your actor if they got cut, don't have them fly to Sundance and then like find out at the premiere sitting between their agents and managers that they're not even in the movie anymore, you know, or like, that happens, you know, like filmmakers get scared. They get scared to confront that and tell the actor. And it's like, you know what? Fuck you. Actually, fuck you. Because like, this person cared so much, put mm-hmm. so much work into it. And we're all adults here. You could have the decency. Like, you weren't scared to just cut the shit out of my performance. So you do, like, to a certain degree, you're going to be a filmmaker. You have to just be brave enough to do the job. Like, there's some parts of it that, you know, there are parts of my job I really don't like doing either, but I find it disrespectful and extra painful when they just don't say anything, as though you're not going to notice that like half of your shit's not in the movie anymore. It's like, yeah. Did you think I wasn't going to, you know? So, so for me, I've been in both situations. I've been in situations where I'm not told. It's a complete gut punch when I see it. And then I've been in situations where like the filmmaker will write a long letter about, not to say that my shit gets cut all the time, but it has happened before. And like one time I did a film where the filmmakers wrote a long letter to really explain why it didn't work. And they were very apologetic about, because, you know, they had made a really strong choice and I committed to that choice, and they didn't feel like it worked in mm-hmm. this, in the arc of the full story. And I really appreciated that. I really appreciated that email, just that was like, we're going to take the time to just explain to you why we made this cut, yeah. because we know how much you care and how much you put into this.
I think it comes up quite a bit, especially, you know, when actors are on, is the idea that there's not always an open line of communication or respect between director and actor, that we've kind of built a certain type of industry that you know, kind of disrespects actors in a sense, you know, that there's a kind of abuse. And of course, the relationship of a director and actor is not like it's not like any other coworker relationship that you're going to find, you know.
It's a lot more intimate, yeah. Mm-hmm. This kind of creative collaboration, it's always intimate. And yeah, I don't like sometimes when it gets treated like just clock in and clock out, and there's no regard to like the emotional state you're in or need to put yourself in that day at work. It's like, this isn't just a normal job. And it depends director to director as far as that, those lines of communication go. But it's so strange to me when they're not more open, because mm-hmm. I'm like, don't you want your movie to be the absolute best thing it could be? Well, that means you're going to have to get really good work out of everybody, and communication is mm-hmm. only going to help with that, you know, and protecting your actors too. Like what you said before about Zelowski saying, you know, I feel I didn't protect Johnny enough from what I was asking her to bring. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't need to be babysat. Like I would, I would get rid of all of the things, the ways people think that they're taking care of actors, to just have like some rehearsals, you know, like you don't need to ever bring me a cup of coffee. I don't need a trailer, but like, if I could get a rehearsal, that'd be sick.
Yeah. I just want to know what you want.
Yeah. Like before showing up on set. And, yeah, it's funny. But I think it's not just with actors. I think, you know, I think sometimes crew gets abused too, for sure. Like I think that there is this mentality of like, oh, you should be happy. You're making movies. Like, and to some degree, like we all are, we're grateful to be there. We got a pretty damn good mm-hmm. job. You know, we get to just like mess around all day and like never grow up. But I don't know. It's a professional setting as well. So like mm-hmm. you have to find that balance. It's not just like the director is doing all of us a favor because they have allowed us to work on their movie. It's like, nah, go fuck yourself. Like, there's just a process. Let's like honor the process. Let's give the process a little bit of space. Mm-hmm. We don't have to be horrified. I do sometimes feel like people think like if you give an actor an inch, they'll take a mile. And it's just like, first of all, don't lump us all in together. We're all different people who work differently. But I just don't think that's true. I think like, if you give me an inch, I'm going to take that little inch and I'm going to like plant all the seeds inside of that inch that I can and try to make the best garden for you out of my soul.
Aww.
So appreciate it.
You know, you're talking about communication and, you know, how you communicate with your actor and rehearsals and things. But I think that a way in to talk about possession in that relationship is to talk about that subway scene and exactly like what went into making that, because with Jalowski in this moment, he said that less was more and directing her in that. He really allowed her to do what she could. And this was all her. And he said, quote, he instructed her to fuck the air, end quote.
Amazing.
But he's, you know, like yeah. adding on to that, he said, quote, it was one time in my lifetime I said almost nothing. Usually you explain, but how can you explain something you cannot understand? How can you explain that out of the fickleness of living in frustrations, instead of talking, she does something in the subway. She evacuates this evil, like menstruation blood. She evacuates something she doesn't even know she has in herself. Once evacuated, be it in words or action, it becomes flesh and blood and starts its own independent life, and it kills. I dare you to give a coherent explanation of the thing, and I dare myself to give a coherent explanation of people, end quote. And there was, you know, in doing of the work, I think he was hoping that Johnny would be able to give voice to no words through her actions, through this, and just like he allowed her to have control over the scene. And I think in a way that, you know, if you're an actor and you want to act, like that's something. It could be really great or really frightening.
Yeah, I sometimes feel like this movie is actor porn for me, because it's just like, I just sit there drooling over how big they get to be, how much they're just allowed to go for it. And mm-hmm. that scene is like the epitome of that. It's a little hilarious that he said less is more, because she was going for less. And it's like, it's so explosive, that moment. But something like fuck the air, like, you have to sometimes think outside of the box in that way. I love that he was able to just tell her something that wasn't about emotions. You know, so often, especially for women on screen, it's like, cry, just cry. Mm-hmm. Like the more you cry, the better you are. And I just think it's kind of bullshit. It's like, I think people, it happens so often where like, just like an actress cries and it's like, she's brilliant. It's like, I don't know, like if I felt soul in it, maybe, but I appreciate that instead of going for something result oriented, like I want you to cry or scream or do, he said, fuck the air. It was more about something kind of gestural and physical, and let whatever's going to come out of you come out like that. That's why this movie feels like experimental theater to me. Mm-hmm. It's so refreshing. Like I can't tell you how often I have acted where I feel like I'm doing nothing. Like I'm instructed essentially to just not move my face mm-hmm. and speak as like quietly as possible. And it's so natural and so believable. And it's like, I want to fucking explode. I just want to act with all of my heart and soul. And that's what they do in this movie. And yeah, him giving her that ownership, like that should happen. I mean, again, it's like, it's so case by case. There are times where I've been really meticulously directed and it's been incredible. Like mm-hmm. I've been like, oh my God, I feel like I don't have to do any of the work. The director is just crafting me like clay. And if I trust them and it turns out good, it's wonderful. There's also been times where that has burned me and I have trusted the director and they've been so micromanagey about my performance and that I feel suffocated. And I'm like, God, there's nothing organic anymore happening. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not playing. I'm just like a computer or something. And so it can work sometimes and other times it can't, but it's nice to just get let off the leash sometimes. Just say, hey, see what happens. Just that whatever you're feeling is valid. Mm-hmm. Because you spend so much time inside of the psyche of this character. And then sometimes it's like, oh, I did all of this work thinking about this character and fleshing them out. And then I just kind of show up and robotically say these memorized lines. Like you in theater, you get more opportunities to kind of play ball, you know, to just like say the line differently each time. Cause you're like, well, tomorrow I'll have another performance. I can switch it. If that didn't work, I'll do something else. But in film,
and you don't have a camera person who's trying to pull focus on you while you're moving back and forth in the space too. Yeah.
But like that scene in the subway, like that might have never happened. And it's so iconic now. Like you said, it's even like people make memes out of it. It's all over the internet because it's just so insane and explosive. But I think that probably happened because he let her go a little bit. He let her just feel what she was feeling. And that's when you have to take those. I think some of the most magical moments in cinema come from these spontaneous kind of improvised moments. There, I can bring up a couple I've done in my films where I'm like, oh, I'm so glad that made it in.
Well, like what? Like what's a favorite?
There's a moment actually in A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night in that famous kind of disco ball scene where the disco ball is going and it's like this really, really slow scene between the vampire, the girl, and Arash, the boy. And there's no words in it. And we were directed to move as slowly as possible, which was also so wonderful because usually everything's like, pick up the cues, talk faster, move faster. Like it's everything's catered to this ADD world we live in. But Anna Lily is what I call her. She goes by Lily sometimes. But anyways, Lily was like, just move as slowly as you want. And anyways, the way it was written was that I was supposed to approach Arash slowly and then put my ear to his heartbeat. And in that moment, I was like, God, for a vampire, a young boy on ecstasy is like filet mignon, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's young, he's on ecstasy. So his blood is like pumping all the way through him. And so I really felt in that moment, like she had to consider eating him before deciding to put her ear on his heart and kind of embrace him. And so when I turned, I just had a moment where I ended up slowly tilting his head back and looking at his neck mm-hmm. and then like making this decision to embrace him. And that wasn't written. That was something that just like came from me to just tilt his head back. And it's actually became one of the stills of the movie. Like somebody has it, that still tattooed actually on them. And I'm like, oh, that was just like me fucking being the girl and being like, wait a second, I have to consider eating him first. And I remember actually like I was very nervous to do that because Lily is one of those meticulous directors who's kind of thought everything through. And mm-hmm. even in the moment, part of my brain was like, oh God, am I going to get in trouble for just kind of, it's something small, you know, it's just like a gesture. But there are other films too, where like there's lines I've improvised and whatever, but that just felt like it was this small thing. I was like, because I felt the liberty to be in it. And she, when they called cut, was like, that was amazing when you did that. So I was like, okay, good. It's about like, you know, creating an environment where I think the actors get to do some of that, because then you might get one of these moments where you're like, wow, that was exactly what this needed to kind of like complete it. Mm-hmm.
It was your subway tunnel moment. I love it.
So in the most like girl, like subdued
vampire, subway tunnel. Well, Sheila, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about Possession and your own life and work. And again, we should remind people that they can see Snowpiercer on TNT on Sunday nights, and that they can see The Rental in drive-ins, select, and then also on VOD, and that starts on
July 24th.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And thank you so much.
Thank you, April.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. Another reminder, it's Max Fun Drive, and this is your shot in becoming a member. And we wanted to thank you so much. Danke, Hamsamida, all of that, all the thank yous in the world. We cannot create this podcast without you. And, you know, Casey's obviously recovering from a bludgeoning and a stabbing, but he wants to thank you as well. Again, if you want to join, all you have to do is go to MaximumFun.org/join. And if you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Both staring at me!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.